don't all of us do right? And with so many stories of wrongdoing around us, how can we learn how to do the right thing at the right time for the right reason? Well, we will find out this hour. Our guest this hour is one of the best-selling self-help authors of this generation. He has appeared on 6 nationally televised PBS specials and is an expert in the fields of family systems and addiction and recovery. You may know him for coining the term inner child. He also brought the term dysfunctional family into the mainstream. And now John Bradshaw has written his first new book in more than 10 years. We will talk to him this hour about reclaiming virtue, how we can develop moral intelligence to do the right thing at the right time for the right reason. And we welcome your input and your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 11 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, May the 11th. We will find out this hour how we can live a life of virtue and how we can teach it to our children in these troubled times. And we will find out how we can tap our inborn moral intelligence and cultivate it in ourselves and others. John Bradshaw is a counselor, motivational speaker, theologian, author of many books, including Homecoming, Reclaiming and Championing Your Inner Child. And he is the author of the brand new Reclaiming Virtue. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm very honored to talk to you, sir. Coming from a dysfunctional family, I wouldn't have known that unless I read your stuff.
Well, you know, I didn't know it either till I got onto it, and somebody said teachers teach what they need to know the most, and so not happy that a lot of people have understood it, but it was sort of my contribution. I was just talking about my own stuff, and that's the same thing I've done in this new book. Tried to show people, what I struggle with for a lot of my life, which was polarization. I was either all good or all bad, but I had a hard time finding the middle ground, which is what virtue is.
Yeah, so explain and define virtue for us.
Well, virtue has several meanings from the Latin vir. One is manly, but the one that I'm using in this book and that Aristotle and Aquinas, who I've used, are philosophers, it means strength, an inner strength. A virtue is like an inner moral performance enhancer. I kind of use that because we've had all these scathing scandals about athletes using drugs as performance enhancers. But this is a natural performance enhancer in helping us to make good moral choices.
Yeah, and we all have this inborn moral intelligence, you say?
Yeah. For the ancient philosophers all believed in a term they called synderesis, which was that we are born, and if you look at any culture, any civilization, no matter how old it is, with an inborn sense that something's right and something's wrong. I mean, even in headhunters, there's taboos and rituals, and there's good, some behavior is good and some behavior is considered bad. Now, unfortunately, that raw intelligence, so often, because of our evolutionary kinship to our family, tends to be very blindsided, that we are good and the others who are unlike us are bad. And that's the kind of polarization that we're living in today that, while I started this book about my own life, and I started writing it before the terrorist attacks in 9/11, suddenly you've got a situation where part of the world is good and part of the world is bad. and are part, we are the great Satan, and for many, you know, for many Muslims, of course, exaggerated horribly by the terrorists. The Quran is a book that certainly doesn't preach what Osama bin Laden's been doing, but you know, we tend to believe that we are good and they are bad, that they are the great Satan. And this is one of the dynamics of wars and a lot of killing in the world, what I call totalistic systems. When you get a moral system which claims to explain everything or have rules for everything, and that it is right and any other unlike it is wrong.
Yeah. Well, we also, I mean, certainly there is some good, there is some evil, there is right, there is wrong. I mean, isn't that the way it is?
Absolutely. But it's when, you know, when I get to the point that everything that I, you know, I was brought up a staunch Roman Catholic and told that ours was the one true church. Years later, when I began to do, you know, my inner child work all over the country and on PBS, I found that the Mormon church said its church was the only true church. I talked to others who said their, you know, we have Baptists, we have Presbyterians, we have Methodists, we have many people. Now, all of them don't claim that they're the only church, but you wouldn't have a different church if there wasn't differences. Now, in the differences within Christianity, you absolutely do have some preachers on television, you know, like John Hesse was calling the Catholic Church the Great Satan, and stuff like that. And so there, it's that tendency to be all right and the other is all wrong. There is right and wrong. There is good and evil. My belief is that evil is the product of man, that God has nothing to do with evil on this earth, but that we are the ones that do evil, and we also have within ourselves the strengths, if we choose to develop a life of virtue.
Yeah, and you don't believe we need to have a belief in God or a God to have a moral compass or to have this virtue?
Well, yes, I do. I mean, I talk about it a lot in the book, that religion is the second source of moral intelligence. Eric Erickson, in his 8 Stages of Man, says that the most important thing for an infant or a child who bonds to their parents, who they really see as all-knowing and all-loving, so they see their parents as godlike. And it's, you know, incredibly important for their parents to have a belief in something greater than themselves, because the children are going to see one day that dad made a mistake or mom made a mistake, and they're not omnipotent. But knowing that mom and dad bow to something greater than themselves is incredibly important, especially in childhood. I say that because later on, when the intellect is mature, people have the obligation, I believe, to challenge this and to come to their own meaning. And I don't believe that a healthy, moral person could ever come to a place where they believe there was nothing greater than themselves. I choose to call that greater than myself God. I am a Christian in my belief in God, but we can't say that everybody believes that. Half the world believes in God, but as Muslim, and there are incredible number of Buddhists and incredible number of people who follow Shintoism. I mean, in other words, we need everyone on this earth. And when I'm writing a moral philosophy, a moral psychological dictum, this is not essentially a theology book. In other words, this is not about, per se, about faith, which is not knowledge. Faith is a gift, and what you believe by faith is not knowledge. That is, it's not a certainty that you can prove with syllogisms. A lot of people mistake that and start acting like they know what God thinks and what God wants, and God gave me tickets to the Badgers game, you know, and God will follow Wisconsin to its championship this year. Some of that I find a little bit over the top.
Let me ask you to use your own story a little bit to explain to our listeners. You studied to be a priest. You also struggled with alcohol problems and even a sexual addiction. How does someone who is a counselor, a theologian, sometimes do the wrong thing himself?
Well, I had a very troubled childhood. My father was an alcoholic. I was a very good little boy. I went to Catholic school. I was the nun's favorite. I helped the ladies in the neighborhood cut the grass. I went to work at 10 years old and was help supporting my mom. But by the time I hit puberty, although I was still making straight A's in high school for the first couple of years, I started drinking and running around with guys from broken homes, and slowly, I realized fairly early on, because I had alcoholic blackouts, which are these periods of brain amnesia, that I had a real serious problem. And this going down to the red light district in Galveston, it was all very coarse and awful. And when I was 21, I went into the seminary because I had been told by priests and nuns that I had a vocation. And what that means is a calling from God. And I don't really know if that's true or not, but it's told many young people, at least that I remember in the Catholic Church and my colleagues who were in the seminary. Now, the first 5 years in the seminary, I was absolutely exemplar. I used to kneel for 4 hours without moving a muscle and take an hour to say the Stations of the Cross, and I was absolutely exemplary seminarian. But slowly, I began to drink. When I had my first vacation to come home, which was after 2 years, I got drunk a couple of times, and of course everybody said, oh well, he's just, you know, he's been in the monastery. And anyway, slowly that drinking got worse and worse. I had no sexual acting out while I was in my vows of celibacy. When I left the priesthood at 31, stayed single for about 3 years, got married, was perfect in my marriage for about 6 years, and then slowly began acting out sexually. That is, mine was having affairs, and did that until August the 11th. It's either August the 11th or August 13th. I always get them mixed up, but it was sort of the sobriety date where I had this experience running on the highway in Minnesota. I'd run about 12 miles, and I saw the face of Christ out on the horizon. It didn't look like the blonde, blue-eyed Jesus. It looked more like a guy that I was running a hospital at that time, a guy that had, it looked like a young Jewish boy. But I got a sense that I was to do what I was supposed to do. That was sort of the message. Do the work you're supposed to do, and you'll never worry about money again. Now, that seemed real strange, although I was a catastrophizer and had been brought up poor, and so money was always a concern, and I worked, almost endlessly because of fear that everything would go away. When I had that experience, I stopped the sexing. That was August the 11th of 1981, and I've been sober, whatever that is, 27 years. And I've been sober from alcohol December the 11th, 1965, so that's about going on 44 years. I'm not at all proud of those things, but that's my life and my story. And they're part of the problem that all good or all bad that I saw plaguing my life. When I sobered up, you know, when I found these guys that had a sex and love addiction group who were buddies of mine in AA, I realized that, you know, that was different than alcoholism. And with alcoholism, I can't drink a drop. The first drink gets you drunk. But with sex addiction, you don't give up sex for the rest of your life, so you have to find moderation. And I did a lot of work with my ex-wife for about, you know, 8 or 9 years, because she also, we know now that if you have an alcoholic, you have a co-alcoholic, that the spouse of an alcoholic is involved in the disease, in the denial process, either trying to fix the addict or enduring the addict, but not confronting the addict's behavior. In sex addiction, you have a COSA, co-sex addicts. And Claudia Black just wrote a new book called Deceived, and it's on co-sex addiction. There's a book out by Claudine Pletcher called Relationships, Addiction and Authenticity. And that book is about her. She's a very good friend of mine. She's 78 years old, and she wrote about her life of living with her very successful lawyer husband, but she was a sex addict, and she was the patient, you know, all-loving, good woman waiting at home, providing him with sex anytime he wanted it, every time he had anxiety or whatever. Anyway, she was... She says that she went to the Meadows for treatment, and so did her husband, and subsequently her whole family. So it actually becomes a family illness, as I tried to say in Bradshaw and the Family, the TV show I did, and in the book, that everybody gets involved in these diseases. It's not in any way to, you know, to delimit the responsibility for it. I have great sadness and have had to grieve those addictions, but as I show in this new book, I call it addictiveness, that it's not enough to just put the cork in the bottle, that I had a hole in my soul. I had a lot of pain from the abandonment, the abuse, and the enmeshment with my mother. And I didn't have a full sense of selfhood, and I had a lot of shame. I was just filled with shame that I, even though I was the president of the class and straight-A student, I was filled with the feeling that I was worthless, that I was flawed and defective. And in my upbringing, shaming was done constantly by my mother and by the nuns and the priests that raised me. So I had that deep sense of shame as an identity, the feeling that I was an imposter, and I had to work through all of that. Yeah, that's a lot of stuff.
Well, it is a lot of stuff, and I need to take a short pause, and I also want to welcome callers to ask their questions of John Bradshaw, counselor, motivational speaker, theologian, author of many books, including Homecoming, Reclaiming and Championing Your Inner Child. His latest book is Reclaiming Virtue, How We Can Develop the Moral Intelligence to Do the Right Thing at the Right Time for the Right Reason. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up later today, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Coming up after 5, caring for elderly loved ones takes a lot of heart, strength, and courage, especially with home care. At Issue after 5, Ben and his guest will discuss elder care and invite your experiences. That's after 5 this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. We are talking with John Bradshaw. He is the author of the just-published Reclaiming Virtue, How We Can Develop the Moral Intelligence to Do the Right Thing at the Right Time for the Right Reason. And we let's go to the phones right away and take our first caller, Kelly in River Falls. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Great. Good morning. This is a wonderful program. Mr. Bradshaw, when you just got done with your discussion about the alcohol and sex addiction issues, your story sounded similar to mine in that I was successful in school, was steered toward the going to the seminary. Where our stories diverge is I've struggled with this thing for over 35 years, going successful and failure and successful and failure. My problem is you talked about seeing the face of Christ, and I don't currently really believe in a lot of this God stuff. I'm more along the lines of, I'm thinking Einstein, where it's, you know, it's not a benevolent being. So I'm wondering how do you have any advice for somebody who's not necessarily a God believer but still has all those same feelings and thoughts you had about shame and the rest, and trying to overcome this sickness, and how to get in touch with this inner child you talked about?
Well, one of the things is that shame, we have two kinds of shame, just like we have two kinds of cholesterol. Shame is an emotion that I think is a gift of God, because it, or at least part of our creation, it lets us know that we're limited. Shame comes up when you've made a mistake. Shame comes up when you have exposed yourself in a certain way. I don't mean sexually, but I mean you've made a blunder. Often parents find children who have violated the rules or whatever, and they parent them in a way that causes bad shame to happen, because they, while they should be accountable for their shame, it should be named for them, they are not shame. In other words, what I see that what you did, you feel ashamed of. Your eyes are looking down or whatever. But anyway, shame can become an identity. But if you have healthy shame, you have to believe that there's something greater than yourself. And that's all I ask in this book, is that you acknowledge that there's something greater than yourself. And Paul Tillich, the great Lutheran theologian, used to say, well, whatever that ultimate concern is in your life, or what is greater than yourself, it is a mystery, but it can't be less than what is our highest longing, and that is to be loved, to have unconditional love. So for me, the easy way for me to understand the higher power is just to consider that there's unconditional love in whatever is greater than myself, which I don't know fully what that is. I know what the scriptures, what we believe out of our scriptures and all of that, but in my heart of hearts, it was something that was a higher power than me. I couldn't control drinking. I couldn't control sex. My God, I certainly can understand that there was something greater than myself, even if it was drinking and sex. So that, I don't know whether that helps you at all, but like going to the meetings and getting in a community of people of like-mindedness, that a group of people that are trying to quit drinking or trying to quit sexing. You have Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, Sexaholics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think you can make it out of this on your own. I know people who, you know, didn't believe in God. They were agnostic. Well, agnostic is different than atheist. An agnostic is just one who says, I don't know. I don't know, but I sure know something's greater than myself. I'm on this sphere, planet Earth, whirling in space, and I certainly did not give myself my existence. So those are things that may or may not be helpful to you. Sometimes I think the best thing people can do is just choose and allow themselves, you know, act as if it is true. In AA, they used to tell me, you know, act yourself into a right way of thinking. Don't try to think yourself into a right way of acting.
Yeah. Kelly, does that help?
You bet. I guess the part of AA that I've always struggled with is the God concept, and it usually, for me, has always turned a lot of times into a Christian revival meeting rather than, like I say, I would identify myself as agnostic. I just don't know.
Well, there's a set, one of the headings of the big book of AA is We Agnostics, Bill W., the founder, you know, the co-founder of AA, was agnostic all his life. The only requirement in AA is to stop drinking. And, you know, run around, there's hundreds of meetings. And you do find that meetings that degenerate into revival. And that's not what AA is, and it's not what it's supposed to be. That may be something else a person does, but that's not about stopping drinking. And SAA, the Sex Addicts Anonymous, is not about a revival. It's about stop this unbridled, out of control sexual behavior that, you know, you use the denial system to keep doing it with.
Yeah.
So that's all I could share with you on that right now.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly, for the call. And I'm John Bradshaw. I'm sorry that I misinterpreted. I saw an interview with you where I thought you were saying that you really don't need, you shouldn't be necessarily just looking at the Bible for the answers on how to, you know, how to reclaim virtue. That it goes beyond that.
Well, I think that the Bible is very important. I have the second person I have in my magnificent moral moments. The book starts with 10 magnificent moral moments, and each one of those magnificent moral moments embodies one of the sources of moral intelligence. And I tell the story of Ruby Bridges, a little six-year-old girl who was the first black girl in one of the schools in New Orleans that was going into segregation. She came to school every day with marshals because the Ku Klux Klan and others were lined up, or members of it were lined up, spitting at her, calling her the N-word. And she would just come to school and turn around and smile. And Robert Coles at Harvard, who wrote the book The Moral Life of Children, it was amazing to him, as it was some of the teachers in the school just wondered how this child could stand up to this constant oppression. And I wrote in the book, it was the religion, it was the minister, and the church she and her mother and father went to that were the sources that gave her the strength to do what she did. Mm-hmm. She and her mother live here in Houston now. There's been a videotape on Ruby Bridges' life, and her mother says beautifully what I'm trying to say in the book, that there's some people who know what's right and wrong. There's some people, the people who argue about what's right and wrong and struggle with right doing and wrong doing, and then there are just other people who do good, and they don't think about it. And I'm trying to get to the virtue of prudence, which Aristotle and Aquinas both felt was the essence of the moral life. It's about right choosing in the moral order. So to choose correctly at the right time, at the right place, with the right person, is the essence of that inner strength that allows you not to go to absolutes. Certainly a person's faith may be there for them, but we are not, you know, just wounded children who don't have any inner resources. Thomas Aquinas says, if that's all we are, this old sort of school of Thomas Hobbes, that we're bad and we're evil from the get-go, it just demeans us and it demeans God. It demeans God to say that you can't do anything on your own. That's what I'm trying to get at, is that we have, the Bible says, I put before you life and death, and whichever you choose, that's what you'll get. In John, it says, greater things than I do, you will do. Paul says, grow up, and that's how I end this book, grow up and be an adult. Jimmy Swaggart does this horrible sexual acting out and comes on national television and tells everybody he's a sinner and that's the nature of man. And it's sort of like the devil made me do it, so I don't have to do anything.
Let's go take some other callers. Candace in Oshkosh, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there, Mr. Bradshaw.
Hi, how you doing, Candace?
Oh, I'm doing awesome. I'm a recovering alcoholic and addict myself, and I totally agree. I can be addicted to anything. I do work a 12-step program in many modalities. I've been clean from the use of chemicals for 10 years.
Good for you.
And your books have really helped me a lot through the years. I get a little emotional because these are tears of joy. But one of the issues I'm having, I'm a 49-year-old woman, empty nester, grandkids, the whole shebang, and I'm still through therapy and my program and stuff. I still struggle with the grief that I cannot be comfortable around my abusive family and parents. I'm one of 8 children.
Mm-hmm.
And the big issue is that I go into their homes. Mostly I'm talking about my parents. And they, you know, they're still there with that verbal abuse and non-supportive, you know. And my big struggle is, you know, if my counselor told me once, my ODF counselor, they said, if you had a friend, Candace, out there, and they were treating you like your parents do, would you be their friend anymore?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, look, this is a great issue because it's what happens to a lot of people in recovery. And, you know, when I do my inner child workshop, which is essentially a grief workshop, it's essentially helping people grieve the wounds and hurts and the shame that they got. And I say at the beginning, the intention of your parents is not relevant. I don't blame parents. A lot of parents believe, like mine, that you shame children. A huge number believe that you hit children. Now, I have a whole chapter, there's about 19 studies of corporal punishment that I've shown in this book and how damaging it is to children. You have to grieve those wounds. Even if your father didn't think he was being abusive, if it was abuse, we've come to see a lot of things as abuse, a lot of things like even covert sexual abuse, where a father's having designs on you, he never says it, but he feels it, and he's looking at you in a strange way or gives you icky kisses. The point is, you've got to grieve that. That means separating from that family of origin. Then the hard thing is going back into it if nobody in there has gotten any therapy. So I say to people, you have to find a family of affiliation. That is, I found a group of people. I've been in a men's group for 28 years, and we meet, you know, once a week, as long as everybody can be there, and it's a very important thing for me. And you need a family of affiliation who understands the dynamics of what you're going through, and sometimes you have to go out and create it for yourself, or find a church group that can be often helpful to people. A lot of the AA meetings are held in churches, and you can find people there and find out where their church is in that community, or find a therapist that has group. You need support, in other words. And what I say to people is you are never, they never have a right to abuse you. And to send yourself back into that abuse is simply not, you know, it's not right. And I say sometimes you just have to work on yourself until you can get strong enough to go back in that family and absolutely confront them. When you talk to me this way, I'm going to leave. I'm telling you that ahead of time. Or if you call me from jail and you're drunk, I'm not going to come and get you. Or if I call you and you're still drinking, I'm not going to talk to you. I'm going to hang up the phone. In other words, I no longer will enter into the sickness that you and Mom have created in this family. I love you, and I'll be there as long as you're not treating me like somebody like dirt. As long as you're not abusing me, you have no right to do that. That does not come with parental being a parent. That's not an ownership. You have a right to the joy of your life. And you're probably just going to have to stick with people where that kind of abuse doesn't happen and put boundaries on your family.
We are talking with John Bradshaw. He is author of Reclaiming Virtue, How We Can Develop the Moral Intelligence to Do the Right Thing at the Right Time for the Right Reason. We'll take more phone calls for him in just a few moments. I'm Joy Cardine. This is The Ideas Network. You're listening to The Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. It's all things political. Kathleen will talk with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert about all things political, the news and the headlines coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with John Bradshaw. He is the author of the new book, Reclaiming Virtue, How We Can Develop the Moral Intelligence to Do the Right Thing at the Right Time for the Right Reason. And John Bradshaw, before we go back to the phones, I want to talk to you about how can we reclaim our virtue? How can we develop our moral intelligence to do the right thing?
Well, I've tried to put suggestions in the book. The middle part of the book is enhancing your own moral intelligence. And it would be, one part of it might be the kind of work that our previous caller might still need to do. I don't want to say that for sure because I don't know, but that is, go into my book, Homecoming, Reclaiming and Championing the Inner Child, is about dealing with separation from abuse, neglect, abandonment, abuse of any kind, physical, sexual, emotional, could even be intellectual or spiritual. That is, we treat a lot of religious addicts, literally, in our treatment center. And that's something that people just don't understand, that God can become a drug and you can avoid all your other responsibilities. So I have, in the third part of the book, chapter 11, is what I think is a missing link in moral education. And it is learning how to become emotionally literate. We now know, since 1965, we have understood that our emotions, that our brain thinks in two ways. One side of it, is the left brain, generally speaking, is rational and sequential and logical. The right brain, or the non-dominant brain, is about feelings. And that is the part of the brain that's developed in the first 3.5 years of life. The thinking brain doesn't come in until a child can speak, and speak rather well. And so all of the early life is emotion to emotion, the mother's right brain to the baby's right brain. And so what that proto-conversation is about is feeling to feeling. And feelings are forms of intelligence. An emotion is from the Latin ex movere. When you have anger, it moves you to take care of yourself, to say that's enough, that's a limit. When you have sadness, it moves you to tears. When you have joy, it moves you to celebration. When you have shame, it moves you to put limits on what you're doing, to realize I'm finite. And so I have a whole developmental chart that I have worked out for teaching emotional literacy. And I've learned this through doing the Inner Child Workshop with over 350,000 people around the world now. So I've developed this chart, and I've given examples of every stage, infancy, toddler, preschool, school age. And then I have a chapter on developing conscience, because part of the virtue of prudence, the virtue of good choosing, knowing how to choose moderately, part of that virtue is an informed conscience. So you need both sides of the brain, but in the earliest part of our development is in feeling. So we need to have literacy, emotional literacy, and we also need to train our will, to habituate our will. So virtue is simple but difficult. If you want to do a good, Aristotle says, which would you rather be? Which would you rather have? You know what virtue, you know what justice is, or you do a just act. One just act already is virtuous. One act of kindness is virtuous. One act of compassion is virtuous. So the important thing is to start doing it. And the more you do it, the more it's going to bring good feeling to you, the more you're going to learn where is the right time? Where is the best place? It's going to take experience. That's another one of the sources of virtue. I have Tuesdays with Maury, the old professor who's dying, who's not teaching Mitch Albom out of a textbook. He's teaching him out of his whole life. This book is about an ethic of virtue based on the virtue of virtues, the engine of the virtues, which is the ability to choose the right thing at the right time for the right reason. In order to do that, you've got to develop your emotional literacy. You've got to develop conscience.
I have a chapter on character. You have to develop a strong ego, not an ego in a bad sense, but an inner monitor that can monitor the inside and the outside of you. And the book goes through this step by step. I can't guarantee anybody that they're going to be virtuous, because it does require right appetite, a good will. I start with the fire department culture at 9/11. You can't pay people to do what those men do, what those men and women were doing. It's a right appetite. They have goodwill. So the missing link in moral education is we have overstressed just teaching people a dogma or a whole bunch of truths and saying, memorize these. It's your duty to follow them. Don't ever question them. And if you do break them, you're going to hell. You're going to be punished. I think there's punishment enough in this life of living an addicted life. I just think that people who live their life in vicious ways, that's their own reward. And virtue is also your own reward. And to go to your death and to have never lived or become a whole functioning person is really, you've chosen death. Ecclesiastes says, I put before you life and death, and whichever you choose, that's what you're going to get. And one of the great theologians, Kierkegaard, says, the omnipotence of God is such that he can give you freedom and remove himself or herself from that freedom so that your act is a responsible moral choice, and it's your act. You're responsible for your life, and you're responsible for your goodness or your badness. That was the whole meaning of the book of Job. The comforters didn't help him, and suddenly this whirlwind and the voice of God said, what do you think, that you can write your own rules? That if you be good, I'll give you money, and I'll give you land, and I'll give you... I didn't make that contract with you. And if you don't be good, I'll send you a plague and a famine and kill all your children. That is the nature you live in. And we have to deal with tornadoes and hurricanes and disease and use our intelligence and our will and the gift of our humanity, which is like God. It's in, you know, I talk about Thomas Aquinas saying that we're made in the image of God. But that means that we need to become functional and functional adults and not whiny children who act so dependent that they are nothing but a bunch of trash and only God can forgive them and only God can help them. And that just doesn't go. And look at the mess we're in with that kind of thinking.
Let me bring in some other callers. John in Madison. Hi, John.
Good morning. I would like to, my background is a Catholic background, and this whole issue of personal shame from authority figures, it rings true with me. But I'm also now a Bible-believing Christian, and I'd like you to draw out the correlation between this aspect of shame in the personality and how sometimes people just transfer their addictive personality from drugs and alcohol and become religious addicts. Explain.
Well, I'll give you a good example. Our counselor, a gal came to me one time who was really seriously addicted, and her father was a very well-known minister in my city. He was known for being the good he did and how he helped so many people. I asked him to come into the therapy when I saw how bad off his daughter was, and the mother, too, because I saw that she was acting out the pain of their marriage. And that's not an excuse in itself, but we know that families are systems. Anyway, he was just almost irate and absolutely patronizing and got up the last 15 minutes of the counseling session and says, you have nothing to tell me. That man died, and his son was a terrible addict. His daughter died of addiction, and the wife, to the day he died, was miserable and left alone, and all of this because he was so good. And you see, once a person identifies himself with goodness, I have a whole chapter 9 in this book is what Carl Jung called the ultimate ethical problem. And what Jesus would say is, judge not lest you be judged. Mm-hmm. Because what people do is they have a shadow part. They have a shame part. They don't want to own it. They don't want to deal with it. And so they project it on other people. They make all the other people bad. They criticize, blame, become righteous, and don't ever look at their own shadow. And their own shadow is what's really causing the problems. So wholeness, I'd rather be whole than good. And the word teleos in Greek, where it says, you know, be ye perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect, it means wholeness. Become whole. Own that you're perfectly imperfect. That you are not God, and that you're perfectly imperfect, and you have shame, and you need to embrace your shame before you start judging everybody else. What happens too often with people who suddenly find Jesus or find God or find healing is that they're now running around, not looking at their own dark side, condemning everybody else, and that's just not healthy or wholesome.
We have one more caller I think that we can fit in before news time. Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, how you doing, Joy, and how you doing, Mr. Brown?
Hi, Michael.
I'm definitely enjoying this conversation, and I think that this type of thought process and this type of curriculum needs to be put in school. But when you were talking about prudence earlier in the hour, and you were making intimating the point that sometimes the faithful can over-rely on God in a sense like, hey, whenever there's something challenging or difficult within the faith, you know, let's just wait on the Holy Spirit and God to help us. And the one point that I would like to add to the conversation is that, you know, I tell a story all the time that we all know that God parted the Red Sea, but Moses had to raise the staff. So there's this duality between, you know, does God and the Spirit move us first, or do we move and then God's Spirit blesses us when we do something virtuous? And one last point, you know, earlier you said, you know, God, whether it be a man, he or she, and I think that sometimes when we open up the question of whether God is a man or a woman, it makes the Bible seem deficient, but the scriptures clearly state that up there in heaven, there is neither male nor female.
Michael, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we're essentially out of time, and I'm sorry, John Bradshaw.
That is a good point he's making, though. Yeah. I think people will become more virtuous who have a faith that, I mean, or at least that is the great, great source that will give you a context to live in to develop your life of faith. But
thank you, John Bradshaw, for being with us. More information in the new book, Reclaiming Virtue, How We Can Develop the Moral Intelligence to Do the Right Thing at the Right Time for the Right Reason. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.